Chapter 6. Flames. A shape filled the doorway, blocking the light. I jumped up from the pallet, knocking over Bronwyn's wooden bowl. Denacious! A hefty arm pointed at us. Come out, both of you!
We will not!
Bronwyn rose to her feet and stood beside me. Denacious' gray eyes flashed angrily. He shouted over his shoulder, Take her first! He entered the hut, followed by two of the boys from the village square. Lud was not with them. I grabbed Denacious by the arm. He shook me off as if I were a fly, throwing me backward into the table bearing Bronwyn's utensils and ingredients. Spoons, knives, strainers, and bowls sprayed across the dirt floor of the hut as the table collapsed under my weight. Liquids and pastes splattered the clay walls, while seeds and leaves flew into the air. Seeing him wrestling with Bronwyn, I sprung to my feet and leapt at him. He wheeled around and smacked me with such force that I flew backward into the wall. I lay there, momentarily dazed. When my head cleared, I realized that I was alone in the hut. At first, I wasn't certain what had happened. Then, hearing shouts outside, I stumbled over to the doorway. Bronwyn lay 20 or 30 paces away in the middle of the path. Her hands and legs were bound with a length of spliced rope. A wad of cloth torn from her dress had been stuffed into her mouth so she could not cry out. Apparently, the merchants and villagers in the square, busy with their work, had not yet noticed her, or not wanted to intervene.
Look at her!
Laughed a slim, grimy-faced boy, pointing at the crumpled figure on the path.
She's not so scary now.
His companion, still holding some rope, joined the laughter.
Serves the she-demon right!
I started to run to her aid. Suddenly, I caught sight of Denacious bending over a pile of loose brush that had been stacked under the wide boughs of the oak. As he slid a shovel full of flaming coals from the smith shop under the brush, fear sliced through me. A fire! He's starting a fire! Flames began crackling in the brush. A column of smoke swiftly lifted into the branches of the tree. At this point, Denacious stood upright, hands on his hips, surveying his work. Silhouetted before the fire, he looked to me like a demon himself.
She says she's not afraid of fire, declared Denacious to the nods of the other boys. She says she cannot be burned.
Let's find out, called the boy with the rope.
Fire! Shouted one of the merchants, suddenly aware of the flames.
Put it out! Cried a woman, emerging from her hut. But before anyone could move, the two boys had already grabbed Bronwyn by the legs. They began dragging her toward the blazing tree, where Denacious stood waiting.
I ran out of the hut, my eyes fixed on Denacious. Rage swelled within me, such rage as I had never known before. Uncontrollable and unstoppable, it coursed through my body like an enormous wave, knocking aside every other sense and feeling. Seeing my approach, Denacious grinned.
Just in time, whelp. We'll cook you both together.
A single wish overwhelmed me.
He should burn. Burn in hell.
At that instant, the tree shuddered and cracked, as if it had been ripped by a bolt of lightning. Denacious whirled around, just as one of the biggest branches, perhaps weakened by his fire, broke loose. Before he could escape, the branch fell directly on top of him, pinning his chest and crushing his arms. Like the breath of a dozen dragons, the blaze leapt higher. Villagers and merchants scattered. Branches exploded into flames, the sound of their snapping and splitting nearly drowning out the cries of the trapped boy. I rushed to Bronwyn. She had been dropped only a few paces from the burning tree. Fire was licking at the edges of her robe. Quickly, I pulled her away from the searing flames and untied her bonds. She pulled the wad from her mouth, staring at me with both gratitude and fear.
Did you do that?
I think so.
Some kind of magic.
Her sapphire eyes fixed on me.
Your magic. Your power.
Before I could reply, a spine-shivering scream erupted from inside the inferno. It went on, a cry of absolute agony. Hearing that voice, that helpless human voice,
My blood froze within my veins. I knew at once what I had done. I also knew what I must do.
No,
protested Branwen, clutching at my tunic.
But it was too late. I had already plunged into the roaring flames. Chapter 7. Hidden.
Voices. Angelic voices.
I sat bolt upright. Could they really be angels? Was I really dead?
Darkness surrounded me, blacker than any night I had ever known. Then, the pain. The pain on my face and my right hand told me I must indeed be alive. It was searing pain, clawing pain, as if my very skin were being ripped away. Beneath the pain, I grew aware of a strange weight on my brow. Cautiously, I reached my hands to my face. The fingers of my right hand, I realized, were bandaged. So were my brow, my cheeks, my eyes, swathed in cold, wet cloths that smelled of pungent herbs. Even the barest touch cut me with daggers of pain. A heavy door creaked open. Across an expanse of stone floor, footsteps approached, echoing from a high ceiling above my head. Footsteps whose cadence I thought I recognized.
Branwen? Yes, my son,
answered the voice in the darkness.
You have awakened. I am glad.
Yet she sounded more dismal than glad, I thought, as she lightly caressed the back of my neck.
I must change your bandages. I am afraid it will hurt.
No, don't touch me.
But I must, if you are to heal.
No,
Emrys, I must.
All right, but be careful. It hurts so much already.
I know, I know.
I tried my best to remain still as she carefully unwrapped the bandages, touching me as delicately as a butterfly. While she worked, she dripped something over my face, which smelled as fresh as the forest after a rain and seemed to numb the pain a little. Feeling somewhat better, I spouted questions like a fountain.
How long have I slept? Where is this place? Who are those voices?
You and I, forgive me if this stings, are at the Church of St. Peter. We are the guests of the nuns who live here. It is they you hear singing.
St. Peter? That's in Caer Murthine.
So it is.
Feeling a cold draft from a window or door somewhere, I drew my rough wool blanket about my shoulders.
But that is several days' travel, even with a horse.
So it is.
But
be still, Emrys, while I untie this.
But
still now. That's right. Just a moment. Oh, there.
As the bandage fell away, so did my questions about how we had come to be here. A new question crowded out all the rest. For although my eyes were no longer covered, I still could not see.
Why is it so dark?
Branwen did not answer.
Didn't you bring a candle?
Again she did not answer.
Is it nighttime?
Still she did not answer. Yet she did not need to, for the answer came from a cuckoo, alive with song, somewhere nearby. The fingers of my unbandaged hand quivered as I touched the tender area around my eyes. I winced, feeling the blotches of scabs, the still burning skin underneath. No hair on my eyebrows, no eyelashes either. Blinking back the pain, I traced the edges of my eyelids, crusted and scarred. I knew my eyes were wide open. I knew I could see nothing. And with a shiver, I knew one thing more. I was blind. In anguish, I bellowed. Suddenly, hearing again the sound of the cuckoo, I flung off my blanket. Despite the weakness of my legs, I forced myself to rise from the pallet, pushing away Bronwyn's hand as she tried to stop me. I staggered across the stones, following the sound. I tripped on something and crashed to the floor, landing on my shoulder. Stretching out my arms, I could feel nothing but the surface of the stones beneath me. They felt hard and cold, like a tomb. My head spun. I could feel Branwen helping me to my feet, even as I could hear her muffled sobs. Again, I pushed her away. Staggering forward, my hands hit a wall of solid rock. The sound of the cuckoo drew me to the left. The groping fingers of my unbandaged hand caught the edge of a window. Grasping the sill, I pulled myself closer. Cool air stung my face. The cuckoo sang so close to me that I might have reached out and touched its wing. For the first time, it seemed in weeks, I felt the splash of sunshine on my face. Yet as hard as I tried to find the sun, I could not see it. Hidden! The whole world is hidden! My legs buckled beneath me. I fell to the floor, my head upon the stones, and I wept. Chapter 8. The Gift. During the weeks stretching into months that followed, my torment filled the halls of the Church of St. Peter. The nuns residing there, moved both by the strength of Branwen's piety and the severity of my burns, had opened the gates of their sanctuary. They must have found it difficult to feel anything but sympathy for this woman who did little else but pray all day and tend to her wounded boy. As to the boy himself, they mostly avoided me, which suited me just fine. For me, every day was dark, in mood as well as sight. I felt like an infant barely able to crawl around the cold stone chamber that I shared with Branwen. My fingers came to know well its four rigid corners, its uneven lines of mortar between the stones, its lone window where I sometimes stood for hours straining to see. Instead of lighting me, though, the window only tortured me with the jovial call of the cuckoo and the distant bustle of Caer Myrddin's marketplace. Occasionally, the smell of someone's cooking pot or a flowering tree might waft to me, mingling with the scents of thyme and beetroot that rose from Branwen's low table by her pallet. But I could not go out to find such things. I was a prisoner, confined in the dungeon of my blindness. Two or three times, I summoned the courage to walk, feeling with my hands past the heavy wooden door and into the maze of corridors and chambers beyond. By listening carefully to the echoes of my footsteps, I discovered that I could judge the length and height of passageways and the size of rooms. One day I found a stairway whose stone steps had been worn into shallow bowls over the years. Feeling the wall carefully as I descended, I pushed open a door at the bottom and found myself in a fragrant courtyard. Wet grass touched my feet, warm wind breathed on my face. I remembered all at once how good it felt to be outdoors on the grass in the sun. Then I heard the nuns singing in the cloisters nearby. I started walking faster, eager to find them. Without warning, I strode right into a stone column so hard that I fell over backward into a shallow pool of water. As I struggled to get up, I stepped on a loose rock and pitched sideways. The left side of my face bashed against the base of the column. Bruised and bloodied, my bandages torn, I lay there sobbing until Branwen found me. After that, I didn't stir from the pallet in my chamber, convinced I would spend the rest of my days as a helpless burden to Branwen. Even when I tried to think of other things, my mind always returned to the day that had been my undoing. The sight of her bound and gagged by the tree, the rage that boiled over so violently, the laughter melting into shrieks of Denatius, the searing flames all around, the crushed arms and broken body beneath the branches, the sound of my own screams, when I realized that my face was burning. I could not remember our trek to the walls of Caer Myrddin, though from Branwen's spare description I could imagine it well enough. I could almost see Lud's round face watching us ride over the hill in the cart of the passing trader who had taken pity on the woman with sapphire eyes and her badly burned son. I could almost feel the swaying of the horse-drawn cart, almost hear the squealing of the wheels and the pounding of the hooves on the towing path. I could almost taste my own charred skin, almost hear my own delirious wailing as we rode through those long days and nights. Now, very little broke the regularity of my days, the singing of the nuns, the shuffling of their footsteps to cloisters, to meals, to meditations. Bronwyn's quiet prayers and chants as she did her best to heal my skin. The continuing calls of the cuckoo, perched in a rustling tree that I could not name. And darkness. Always darkness. Sometimes, as I sat on my pallet, I ran my fingers gingerly over the scabs on my cheeks and under my eyes. The ridges on my skin felt terribly deep, like the bark of a pine tree. I knew that, despite Bronwyn's skills, my face would be scarred forever. Even if, by some miracle, my sight were ever restored, those scars would announce my folly to the world. I knew, of course, that such thoughts were foolishly vain. Yet they came to me anyway. Once I found myself longing to grow a beard. I imagined a great flowing beard, the kind an ancient sage hundreds of years old might wear. What a beard that was! All curly and white, it covered my face like a mass of clouds. I even suspected that a bird or two might try to nest there. But such wistful moments never lasted long. Increasingly, I felt gripped by despair. Never again would I climb a tree. Never again would I run freely through a field. Never again would I see Bronwyn's face, except in memory. I began to leave my meals untouched. Despite Bronwyn's insistence that I eat more, I had no desire. One morning, she knelt beside me on the stones of our chamber, wordlessly dressing my wounds. As she tried to replace my bandage, I leaned away from her, shaking my head. I wish you had left me to die.
It was not your time to die.
How do you know? I snapped. I feel like I've died already. This is not a life. This is endless torture. I prefer to live in hell than to live here. She seized me by the shoulders.
Don't talk that way. It is blasphemy.
It is the truth. See what your powers, the ones you called a gift from God, have done for me? Curse these powers. I'd be better off dead.
Stop it!
I shook free, my heart pounding. I have no life. I have no name. I have nothing. Bronwyn, swallowing her sobs, began to pray.
Dear Lord, Savior of my soul, author of all that is written in the great book of heaven and earth, please help this boy, please. Forgive him. He knows not what he says. If only you would restore his sight, even a little, even for a while. I pledge to you he will earn your forgiveness. He will never use his powers again, if that is what it takes. Only help him, please, help him.
Never use my powers again? I scoffed. I would gladly give them up in exchange for sight. I never wanted them anyway. Bitterly, I tugged the bandage on my brow. And what kind of life do you have now? Not much better than mine. It's true. You may talk bravely. You may fool those nuns out there, but not me. I know you are miserable.
I am at peace.
That is a lie.
I am at peace,
she repeated. At peace, I shouted. At peace? Then why are your hands so chafed from all your wringing? Why are your cheeks so stained with your... I never finished the sentence.
Good God,
she whispered. I don't understand. Hesitantly, I extended a hand toward her face, lightly brushing her cheek. In that instant, we both realized that I could, somehow, sense her tear stains. Though I could not see them with my eyes, I nonetheless knew they were there.
It is another gift.
Bronwyn's voice was full of awe. She clasped my hand tightly.
You have the second sight.
I didn't know what to think. Was this the same ability that I once used to open a flower's petals? No, it felt different. Less willful, somehow. What about seeing the colors inside the flower before it opened? Perhaps. Yet this felt different from that, too. More like an answer to Bronwyn's prayer. A gift from God. Can it be? I asked meekly. Can it really be?
Thanks to God, it can.
Test me, I demanded. Hold up some fingers. She obliged. I bit my lower lip, trying to perceive her fingers. Two?
No. Try again.
Three.
Try again.
Focusing my thoughts, I instinctively closed my eyes, though of course that made no difference. After a long pause, I said,
Two hands, not one. Am I right?
Right. Now, how many fingers?
Minutes passed. Perspiration formed on my scarred brow, stinging the sensitive skin, but I didn't waver. At length, I asked a hesitant question.
Could it be seven?
Bronwyn sighed with relief.
Seven it is.
We embraced. I knew in that moment that my life had changed completely, and I suspected that for the rest of my days, I would continue to ascribe special importance to the number seven. Most important of all, though, I knew that a promise had been made. It didn't matter whether it had been made by me, by Bronwyn, or by us both. I would never again move objects with my mind, not even a flower petal. Nor would I read the future, or try to master whatever other powers might once have been mine. But I could see again. I could live again. Right away, I started eating, and hardly stopped, especially if I could get bread and milk, my favorite, or blackberry jam on bread crusts, or mustard mixed with raw goose eggs, which gave me the added fun of making any nearby nuns ill. One afternoon, Bronwyn went out to the market and found a single succulent date, which was, for us, as splendid as a royal feast. And my spirit revived along with my appetite. I began to explore the hallways, the cloisters, the courtyards of St. Peter. The whole church was my domain, my castle. Once, when no nuns were about, I stole into the courtyard and took a bath in the shallow pool. The most difficult part was to resist singing at the top of my lungs. Meanwhile, Bronwyn and I worked together every day for long hours, trying to sharpen my second sight. For my first practice sessions, we used spoons, pottery bowls, and other ordinary utensils that she found somewhere in the church. In time, I moved on to a small altar with subtle contours and grains in its wood. Eventually, I graduated to a two-handled chalice with intricate carvings on its surface. Although it took the better part of a week, I finally came to read the words inscribed on its rim. Ask, and ye shall receive. As I practiced, I realized that I could see objects best if they were stationary and not far away. If they moved too quickly or remained too distant, I often lost them. A flying bird simply melted into the sky. Furthermore, as the light around me grew dimmer, so did my second sight. At dusk, I could see only the blurred outlines of things. I could not see anything at night unless a torch or the moon pushed back the darkness. Why my second sight should need light at all, I could only wonder. It was, after all, not like normal sight. So why should darkness smother it? Then again, second sight seemed to be partly inward and partly outward. Perhaps it relied on what was left of my eyes in some way I could not comprehend. Or perhaps it required something else, something inside me, which failed to pass the test. Thus, while second sight was certainly better than no sight at all, it was not nearly as good as the eyesight I had lost. Even in daylight, I could discern only the barest wisps of colors, leaving most of the world painted in variants of gray. So while I could tell that Bronwyn now wore a cloth veil around her head and neck, and that it was lighter in color than her loose robe, I could not tell whether the veil was gray or brown. I began to forget much of what I had learned about the colors of things since arriving in Gunith. Yet I could accept such limitations, oh yes, and gladly. With my emerging ability, I walked to the cloisters or to meals with Bronwyn. I sat beside a nun and conversed for some time, seeming to look at her with my eyes, without her suspecting that those eyes remained useless. And one morning I actually ran around the courtyard, weaving in and out of the columns, leaping right over the pool. That time, I didn't hold back my singing.
Chapter 9. The Young Bird. As my second sight improved, Bronwyn helped me to read the Latin inscriptions in the religious manuscripts at the church. Strong smells of leather and parchment washed over me every time I cracked open one of those volumes. And the images, stronger still, carried me away to the flaming chariot of Elijah, the Last Supper of Jesus, the stone tablets of Moses. Sometimes, as I pored over those texts, my troubles melted away. I became one with the words, seeing deeds and colors and faces with richness and clarity that I could never see with my eyes. And I came to understand, in a way I never had before, that books are truly the stuff of miracles. I even dared to dream that someday, somehow, I might surround myself with books from many times and many tongues, just as Bronwyn had once done. With each passing day, my vision grew a little stronger. One morning, I discovered that I could read Bronwyn's expression by the curl of her lips and the glint of her eyes. Another morning, as I stood by my window watching the wind toss the branches, I realized that the rustling tree where the cuckoo lived was a hawthorn, broad and dark. And one night, I glimpsed for the first time since before the fire a star shining overhead. On the next night, I positioned myself in the center of the courtyard, far from any torches. Lo, on the northern horizon, a second star glittered. The next night, three more, then five more, eight more, 12 more. Bronwyn joined me in the courtyard the following evening. Together we lay on our backs on the stones. With a sweep of her hand, she pointed out the constellation Pegasus. Then, slowly and rhythmically, she told me the tale of the great winged horse. As she spoke, I felt I was soaring through the sky on Pegasus' broad back. We leapt from one star to another, sailed past the moon, galloped across the horizon. Every night after that, unless clouds completely covered the sky, Bronwyn and I lay there under the dome of darkness. As much as I loved reading the church's manuscripts, reading the manuscript of the heavens thrilled me even more. With Bronwyn as my guide, I spent my evenings in the company of Cygnus, Aquarius, and Ursa, whose claws raked my back several times. I tied the sails of Vela, swam far with Pisces, marched beside Hercules. Sometimes, while exploring the stars, I imagined the entire sky shrinking down into a single, glorious cape. In a flash, I would put it on, deep blue, studded with stars. The cape fell over my back, sparkling as I moved, the stars riding my shoulders, the planets ringing my waist. How I would love to own a cape like that one day. Yet even as I celebrated, I could not forget how much lay hidden from me. The clouded sky obscured some of the stars. My clouded vision obscured more. Still, the thrill of all I could see far outweighed the frustration with what I could not. Despite the clouds, the stars had somehow never seemed so bright. And yet, there remained a dark place inside of me that even the light from stars could not reach. The ghosts of my past continued to haunt me, especially what I had done to Denatius. I still heard his screams, still saw the terror in his eyes, still felt the twisted and useless remains of his arms. When I asked Bronwyn whether he had survived, she couldn't say. She only knew that he was still hovering at the edge of death when we had left the village. Still, this much was clear. While he had done plenty to provoke my rage, his brutality could not obscure my own. On top of that, something else continued to plague me, something deeper than guilt. Fear. About myself and my dreadful powers. The merest thought of them threw up a wall of flames in my mind, flames that seared my very soul. If I lacked the strength to keep my promise, would I use those powers or would they use me? If,
In the grip of uncontrollable rage, I could destroy both a person and a tree with such ease. What else might I one day destroy? Could I annihilate myself completely as I did my own eyes? What kind of creature am I, really? Perhaps Dionysius had been right, after all. Perhaps the blood of a demon really did flow through my veins, so that terrible magic could rise out of me at any moment, like a monstrous serpent rising out of the darkest depths of the sea. And so it was, even in the new brightness of my days, that I remained troubled by the darkness of my own fears. As the weeks passed, my vitality, as well as my vision, continued to grow. Yet my unease continued to grow as well. I knew down inside that I could never put my fears to rest until I somehow learned my true identity. There came an afternoon when I heard a new sound outside the window of my chamber. Eagerly, I moved closer. By stretching my second sight, I found the source of the sound, nestled among the boughs of the hawthorn tree. I watched and listened for a while. Then I turned back to Bronwyn, who sat in her customary place on the floor next to my pallet, grinding some herbs.
"The cuckoo has nested in the hawthorn tree."
I spoke with a mixture of certainty and sadness that made Bronwyn put down her mortar and pestle.
"I have watched her, seen her sitting in the nest every day. She laid her only egg there. She guarded it from enemies. And now, at last, the egg has hatched. The young bird has emerged from the darkness."
Bronwyn studied my face carefully before responding.
"And,"
she asked in a trembling voice,
"has the young bird flown?"
Slowly I shook my head.
"Not yet, but very soon he must."
"Can he not?"
She had to swallow before trying again.
"Can he not stay with his mother for a while longer, sharing their nest for a little more time?"
I frowned. "All things must fly when they are able."
"But where? Where will he go?"
"In this case, he must find his own self." After a pause, I added, "To do that, he must find his own past." Bronwyn clutched at her heart.
"No, you don't mean that. Your life will be worth nothing if you go back there."
"My life will be worth nothing if I stay here." I took a step toward her. Though my eyes were useless, I probed her with my newfound gaze. "If you cannot or will not tell me where I came from, then I must find out myself. Please understand, I must find my true name. I must find my true mother and father. I must find my true home."
"Stay,"
she begged in desperation.
"You are only a boy of 12, and half blind as well. You have no idea of the risks. Listen to me, Emrys. If you stay with me for just a few more years, you will reach manhood. Then you can choose whatever you want to be, a bard, a monk, whatever you like."
Seeing my blank look, she tried a different approach.
"Whatever you do, don't decide right now. I could tell you a story, something to help you think through this madness. What about one of your favorites? The one about the wandering druid who saved Saint Brigid from slavery."
Without waiting for me to answer, she began.
"There came a day in the life of young Brigid when she..."
"Stop," I shook my head.
"I must learn my own story."
Weakly, Bronwyn clambered to her feet.
"I left behind more than you will ever know. Do you know why? So we could be safe, you and I. Is that not enough for you?"
I said nothing.
"Must you really do this?
You could come with me."
She leaned against the wall for support.
"No, I could not."
"Then tell me how to get back there."
"No, or at least where to begin. No."
I felt a sudden urge to probe the inside of her mind as if it were the inside of a flower. Then the flames ignited, overwhelming my thoughts. I remembered my promise, and also my fears.
"Tell me just one thing," I pleaded. "You told me once that you knew my grandfather. Did you also know my father?"
She winced.
Yes, I knew him.
Was he, well, not human? Was he a demon?
Her whole body stiffened. After a long silence, she spoke in a voice that seemed a lifetime away.
I will say only this. If ever you should meet him, remember, he is not what he may seem.
I will remember. But can't you tell me anything more?
She shook her head.
My own father! I just want to know him!
It is better you do not.
Why?
Instead of answering, she just shook her head sadly. She went to the low table bearing her collection of healing herbs. Deftly, she picked a few, then ground them into a coarse powder which she poured into a leather satchel on a cord. Handing me the satchel, she said resignedly,
This might help you live a little longer.
I started to respond, but she spoke again.
And take this, from the woman who would have you call her mother.
Slowly she reached into her robe and pulled out her precious pendant. Despite my limited vision, I could see the flash of glowing green.
But it's yours.
You will need it more than I.
She removed the pendant and squeezed its jeweled center one last time before placing the leather cord around my neck.
It is called the Galator.
I caught my breath at the word.
Guard it well,
she continued.
Its power is great. If it cannot keep you safe, that is only because nothing outside of heaven can.
You kept me safe. You built a good nest.
For a while, perhaps, but now...
Tears brimmed in her eyes.
Now you must fly.
Yes, now I must fly. Gently she touched my cheek. I turned and left the room, my footsteps echoing down the corridor of stone. Chapter 10. The Old Oak. As I stepped through the carved wooden gates of the Church of St. Peter, I entered the bustle and confusion of Caer Mirthin. It took some time for my dim vision to adjust to all the commotion. Carts and horses clattered along the stony streets, as did donkeys, pigs, sheep, and a few hairy dogs. Merchants bellowed about their wares. Beggars clutched at the robes of passers-by. Spectators gathered around a man juggling balls, and people of all descriptions strode past, carrying baskets, bundles, fresh greens, and stacks of cloth. I glanced over my shoulder at the hawthorn tree, whose branches I could barely make out above the church wall. For all the pain I had experienced in that place, I would miss the quiet calm of my room, the slow singing of the nuns, the bird in the boughs of that tree. And more than I ever expected, I would miss Branwen. Watching the blur of people, animals, and goods, I noticed some sort of shrine on the opposite side of the street. Curious, I decided to get closer, although that would require swimming across the fast-flowing river of traffic. Biting my lip, I started across. Instantly, I was pushed and kicked, turned and buffeted. Since I could not see well enough to stay out of the way, I crashed into a man carrying a load of firewood. Sticks flew in all directions. So did curses. Then I walked straight into the flank of a horse. Seconds later, I nearly lost my toes under a cartwheel. Somehow, though, I made it to the other side. I approached the shrine. It was not much of a monument, just a carved image of a hawk above a bowl of muddy water. If any people took care of it, they had not done so in years. The hawk's wings had broken off. The stones around the base were crumbling. Probably only a handful of the people who strode by here every day even noticed it. Yet something about this old, forgotten shrine intrigued me. I drew closer, touched the hawk's worn beak. I knew enough from Branwen's descriptions to guess that the shrine was probably made to honor Mirthin, one of the ancient Celts' most revered gods, who sometimes took the form of a hawk. One of their Apollos, as she would say. Although I still could not quite accept her notion that such spirits still walked the land, I wondered again about the stag and the boar who had fought over us so long ago. If they were, in fact,
Dagda, and Rita Gaur. Was it just possible that the spirit of Mirthin still lived as well? A donkey, loaded down with heavy sacks, knocked into me. I fell into the shrine, plunging my hand into the murky water, as I stood and shook my hand dry. I tried to imagine what Caer Mirthin might have looked like centuries ago. Branwen had told me that instead of a bustling city, it was just a peaceful hill with a spring where wandering shepherds might pause to rest. Then, over time, it grew into a trade center, taking goods from the farms of Gunnedd and regions as distant as Gwaint, Brychenig, and Poeshfadog. When the Romans came, they built a fortress on the River Tui's high banks, and now the old military roads, such as the one at Caer Vedwit, linked the city to the lush valleys and deer-filled forests of the north, and also down the river to the sea. Whether or not anyone today took the time to remember such things, this crumbling shrine and the name of the city itself still connected Caer Mirthin to its distant past. That, I realized, was the purpose of my own journey, to connect myself with my past, to find my name, my home, my parents. And though I had no idea where this journey might take me, nor where it might end, I suddenly knew where it should begin. The sea, I must return to the sea, to the very spot where I had tumbled onto the rocky shore more than 5 years ago. Perhaps when I arrived at that forbidding shore, I would find nothing but jagged rocks and screeching gulls and pulsing waves, or perhaps I would find the clue that I sought, or at least a clue to the clue. It was not much of a hope, but it was the only hope I had. For what seemed like hours, I wandered through the city, trying to keep to the smaller side streets to avoid being trampled in the traffic. As if I were not already aware of the limits of my vision, I tripped and stumbled enough times to make my toes horribly tender within my leather boots. Even so, I made my way. While I am sure many people concluded, correctly, that I was a clumsy oaf, I'm just as sure none of them guessed that my eyes were totally useless. The occasional words of sympathy I received were for my scars, not for my blindness. At last, I found my way to the road that ran beside the River Tui. I knew that if I followed it far enough to the north, I would return to my old village. From there, I would make my way to the sea. At last, I came to the walls of the city, 10 paces thick and twice as tall. I crossed the wide bridge, taking care not to trip on the uneven stones. Then I continued into the wooded valley beyond. As I plodded along beside the river, I concentrated on each step. If my attention wavered, even briefly, I was likely to end up on the ground. Too often, I did. Once, I tripped in the middle of a village square where a donkey almost stepped on my back. Still, I managed well enough. For 3 days, I walked, eating raspberries and brambleberries, along with the round of cheese given to me by one of the nuns. During that time, I spoke to no one, and no one spoke to me. One day at dusk, I helped a shepherd pull his lamb out of a pit, receiving a crust of bread in thanks, but that was my only contact with others. In time, the road turned into the old towpath through Caer Vedwit. Barges floated down the river, sliding past the families of ducks and swans. As I drew near the village, I kept to the cover of the woods, staying parallel to the path without actually walking on it. That way, no one saw me. Occasionally, I feasted on roots and berries and edible leaves. I drank once again from the rivulet below the great pine tree where I rode out the gale, but I wished that I had never climbed down. In a strange way, I felt more at home here, in the wild woods, than anywhere else in Gunnedd. Late that afternoon, I paused near the bridge at Caer Vedwit. I caught a glimpse of a tall but twisted figure standing at the other end of the bridge. I strained to make it out more clearly as the wind swelled around me. It could have been a decrepit tree, except that I had never noticed a tree in that spot before. I could not shake the feeling that it was, instead, the bent body of a person with nothing but stumps for arms. I did not linger. Despite the obstacles, I tromped through the woods for some distance, avoiding the next several villages as well.
As the shadows grew longer, my vision worsened and my progress slowed. Finally, having left any signs of people behind, I broke into a wide meadow. Scraped from my falls and exhausted from my trek, I found a hollow in the soft grass and curled up to sleep. Sunlight on my face woke me. Crossing the meadow, I rejoined the road near the point where it left the river. But for one elderly man whose scraggly white beard bounced on his chest as he walked, I met no one else on this stretch. I observed the old man, wishing again that I too could grow a beard to hide those miserable scars. One day, perhaps, if I lived so long. Despite the lack of settlements, I did not feel disoriented. My memories of the way to the sea remained surprisingly clear. For though I had traveled this route only once in my life, I had walked it many times in my dreams. My slow shuffle started to gain speed. I could almost hear the distant sound of slapping waves. Every so often I reached into my tunic and touched the Galator. As little as I knew about it, I felt oddly comforted to know it was there. The same was true for Bronwyn's leather satchel slung over my shoulder. The old road gradually deteriorated until it became no more than a grassy trail. At last, it passed through a cleft in a wall of crumbling cliffs. I smelled the barest whiff of salt on the air. I knew this place, knew it in my bones. Black rock rose vertically to 20 times my own height. Kittiwakes called and swooped among the crags. The trail bent sharply to the right, ending where I knew it would. At the ocean. Before me stretched the gray-blue waters without any end and without any bottom. The smell of kelp tickled my nostrils. Waves rushed forward and withdrew, grinding sand against rock. Gulls circling above the shore shrieked noisily. I crossed the black barrier of rocks, stepping over tidal pools and shards of driftwood. Nothing has changed, I told myself. As waves washed over my feet, I gazed westward. The fog of my vision merged with the fog on the water. I strained to see more clearly, but it was impossible. Nothing has changed. The black rocks, the briny breeze, the endless rhythm of the waves. Just like before. Did they hide a clue somewhere? If so, how could I ever hope to find it? The sea was so enormous, and I was so tiny. My head dropped lower on my chest. Aimlessly, I started to walk, my leather boots splashing in the chill water. Then I saw one shape that had changed. The ancient oak, though still mammoth, had been shorn of most of its bark, which sat in tattered strips among the roots. Several branches, broken and splintered, lay strewn across the rocky beach. Even the hollow in the trunk where I had endured the attack of the boar had been punctured, its walls split and buckled. The old tree had finally died. As I approached its remains, I tripped, stabbing my shin on a pointed rock, but I cut short my own howl of pain, not wanting to alert any wild boars that might be near. Whether or not the boar I had met here was really Rita Gower, it had certainly wanted blood on its tusks. If a boar appeared now, I would have no place to hide, and almost certainly no Dagda to rescue me. My shoulders ached, as did my legs. I sat down on the lifeless roots. As I ran my hand along the edge of the hollow, I could still feel the marks of the boar's slashing tusks. That experience felt so close, so recent. And yet this ancient tree, whose strength had then seemed eternal, was now nothing more than a skeleton. I kicked at a shred of bark by my foot, knowing that I myself had fared little better. I had returned to this spot, if not yet dead, then perilously close. I was nearly blind. I was utterly lost. I sat there, my head in my hands. Absently, I stared at the shoreline. The tide, I could tell, was beginning to retreat. Gradually, the border widened between the harsh rocks and the sea, leaving a strip of sand whose contours contained their own tiny mountains and oceans. A hermit crab skittered across this landscape of sand. I watched as the crab wrestled with a half-buried shell at the edge of a tidal pool. After much clawing and scraping, the crab finally retrieved its prize, a conch streaked with a color that reminded me vaguely of orange. I imagined the crab celebrating that it had, at last, found a new home. But before it could savor its success, a sudden sea breeze blew the shell out of its grasp. The shell slid into the shallow pool, floating like a tiny raft, bouncing on the ripples. Seeing the stranded crab watch its hard-earned treasure float away, I allowed myself a sardonic grin. That is how it works. You think you have found your dream, then you lose it forever. You think you have found your home, then you see it float away. Float away. Despite my better judgment, I felt suddenly possessed by an idea, a wild, hopeless, mad idea. I would build a raft. Perhaps this very tree, which had helped me once before, could help me again. Perhaps this very tide, which had borne me once to shore, could bear me out to the sea. I would trust, simply trust, in the tree, in the tide. I had nothing to lose except my life.